Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Nikki Giovanni, who reads from and discusses her two new books, Lincoln and Douglas, An American Friendship, published by Henry Hole, and Hip Hop Speaks to Children, A Celebration of Poetry with a Beat, published by Source Books. In the weeks to come, we have Julia Glass, Alice Schroeder, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and first of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your local and independent businesses. It is my pleasure to introduce this evening's guest speaker, world-renowned poet, writer, commentator, activist, and educator, Nikki Giovanni. Nikki's work has inspired so many that she is often referred to as a national treasure, and it is no surprise that she's been receiving awards and honors since 1970. Just to name a few, Nikki was the first recipient of the Rosa Parks Women of Courage Award. She's also been inducted into the Ohio Women's Hall of Fame and made the list of Oprah Winfrey's 25 Living Legends. Then, there is my favorite, and perhaps not as well known, but a scientist who admires her even named a new species of bat after her. So Nikki is here tonight to present her newest book for young readers, newest books, Hip Hop Speaks to Children, A Celebration of Poetry with a Beat, and Lincoln and Douglas, An American Friendship. So without further ado, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Nikki Giovanni.
Well, thank you. I'm always laughing because in my professional life, I'm a Tennessean by birth. I was born in Knoxville. And I grew up in Cincinnati, which is actually they don't ever say it that way, but it's the top of Appalachia. But my professional life, I'm a New Yorker. And one of the things that, and I love New York, it's a great city. If you're going to be a writer, I mean, you know, of course, Denver's wonderful, but... And then you have good writers out here too, but you know, New York is a really good idea. But the thing that they're always doing, so I'm always very cautious, you know, you're not allowed, New York is a union town, and you really are not allowed to touch things. So if the mic needs to come down, you need to call someone, and he's the mic man, and he'll come in and do that. I made the mistake, I was on a TV set once, and the chair needed to be moved. I just picked up a chair and moved. I'm a Southerner, you know, it's like, you can't do that, you know, it's against union rules. And so they went over there. I like union, so I don't have a problem with that, because without unions, you know, there'd be no Sunday. That's true, you know, you'd be there. And a lot of things drive me crazy, so I'm trying not to be, you know, particularly crazy tonight, but you know, it's being pushed lately, you know. No, I was going to see Sarah Palin, and just, you know, bad things happen. Totally makes you crazy. No, it really, really does. And I have a hard time because the kids, you know, and not the kids aren't doing anything. The Virginia Tech is, of course, Democrat, but not of course, but they are. I mean, you know, because, you know, you just like a little fucking hope. You know what I'm saying? Not a whole lot, just a little bit to something that kind of works. But I'm not here for any of that. I just wanted to mention this. Okay. Or as my mother would finish your sentence, Nikki. Okay, let's start with this, because I'm talking about what's making me crazy. I really had a good time with this book, but one of the things that I wanted to do when I started working on this book came about because there was a book called Poetry Speaks to Children, which was a really good book, and I was very fortunate to be a part of that, because for those of us who are the writers in the room, you know that unless you're a part of something that works sometimes, you don't get anything else done. And so at one point, when this came out and Rosa came out, and Caroline Kennedy's books, Family Pictures, came out, so I was a part of the number one, number two, and we were, with Rosa, were number three bestsellers in New York Times, which gives you a little juice, a little bit, if you're not pushing for too much. And Dominique Rocca, that's the truth. You know, you can ask for something, you probably won't get them. But Dominique and I were talking, and I said, Dominique is the publisher, and she's one of the few women publishers of a company. You know, HarperCollins, which is my basic company. Now, Lisa Gallagher is now our publisher, but HarperCollins is owned by 8,000 people who probably don't even read books. Thank God Lisa does. Michael does. Michael is really good, but the rest of them we're not sure about. But Dominique, you'd be amazed if people think of books as commodities. And it's not that, you know, we don't want books to, you know, earn money and stuff like that, but books not a commodity. Ice cream comes a commodity. Books are a necessity. And you know, you that's true. Very different. But I was talking to Dominique, and I said, Dominique, you know, it was really wonderful. We had a good run, because we did. And when you looked at New York Times, you know, all the things are in line, all the stars are in line. I said, when are you going to do Hip Hop Speaks to Children? And she said, oh, we ought to think about doing that. And I said, yeah, we should. You know, it's just one of those, because I'm always throwing things out, and sometimes, you know, it sticks, sometimes it doesn't. And then I was at the Chicago Book Festival, which is a wonderful book festival. If you're ever going to Chicago, that's the time to go, because it's a lot of fun. It's in the park and stuff. And I was getting ready to take the main stage, and Dom had come over to, you know, just to say hello and how you doing, things like that. And I said, Dom, what are you thinking? You know, when are we going to do hip-hop? And she said, oh, yeah, we'll do it. Why not? We'll do it. I said, great, great. And so I walked up on the main stage, and I said, lady standing over there is named Dominique Rocca. I said, raise your hand, Dom. And she raised her hand, right? And I said, Dom just agreed to do Hip-Hop Speaks to Children. And so, well, I thought that way, then everybody would know she was committed to the book, you know. But actually, she's a good partner, and my good friend and editor, Todd Green, who has now gone over to McGraw-Hill, and it's a loss as far as I'm concerned. But Todd was a big, big, big help in doing this. So we started to think about it. Well, you know, hip-hop is big. And so my contribution to the book is not actually going to be that I'm going to actually pick some of it. I'm only good. I have, this is show and tell, I have a tattoo that says Thug Life. And I'm only probably good up to Tupac, you know. I know a little bit about, because I'm old school. And so I know a little bit about Kanye West, because Kanye gives me shout outs, and his mother, Donda, and I'm so sorry that she's lost, but Donda was a fan of mine, something like that, you know. So I knew I needed a committee, because that's one of the ways we do books at Source Books. We bring committees in. So my committee, of course, was Michelle Scott, who works over at Sony, a wonderful, extremely knowledgeable young woman, and Willie Perdomo, because I just love what Willie does, and I thought, I want to work with Willie. And, of course, Tony Medina, and Tony is a professor, as you know, and a poet in his own right. So that's going to be, you know, what we're going to pull together. My contribution is going to be I connect dots. And it really is something that I enjoy doing, because it's something I'm always thinking about. Because there's an old expression, everything old is new again. But there's really nothing kind of like that nobody's ever seen before, you know, and it's one of those things. And hip-hop bothered me because people bitch and moan about hip-hop, and they're like, oh, it's really terrible. And I think, I've heard that before. Didn't they say that about rock and roll? Didn't they say that about Ray Charles? Didn't they say that about Aretha Franklin? Didn't they say that about Elvis Presley? He's going to corrupt the... Haven't you always heard that the one generation hates the music of the other? And you think, oh, get over it. You know, I mean, really, you have to get over it. I listened to my mother's music, which meant that she had to listen to mine. My mother never did, and I can share this. I'm not proud of it. But Mommy, she never did like Ray Charles. And she would always say, why does that Negro stutter? Wow, he doesn't stutter, you know. But I listened to Billy Eckstein, and of course, my grandmother thought Billy Eckstein was dirty, because classic though he is, Billy Eckstein saying jelly, 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 jelly stays on my mind. And you cannot corrupt the young. So I always thought, why is he singing about peanut butter and jelly? I mean, I was old before I realized that's a metaphor. But you know. So every generation, please come in, every generation has something that they bitch and moan about. But when I was thinking about this, I thought, okay, what are the elements that are coming together? And this is how I'm going to approach this book. The element that was going to be essential is vernacular. Because hip-hop is a vernacular. And once you take it to, oh, it's a vernacular, of course. Once the Romans, and I'm a fan of the Romans, I like Rome, actually. But once the Romans realized you just can't continue to put people in arenas with wild animals, and everybody else is standing around watching them get killed. And then when you decide to improve upon that, you put men with short daggers and chains in an arena with men with long daggers and sticks, and everybody watches them get killed. I don't see the entertainment of murder, and I'm glad the Romans finally got over it. You know, I can't look at Law and Order, though. I can't. I don't see what's exciting and interesting about a murder. I can't look at Nancy Grace. I just can't, you know, and I try because, you know, she's kind of interesting. But I was just like, no, I cannot handle Nancy Grace anymore, because there's always somebody dead and she's always attacking us. Like, come on, let's do something with somebody alive. Romans, of course, recognize, well, I'm in favor of life. I think it's a good idea. But the Romans, and we're going to go back to them for a second. Rome was, as you know, 90% slave, 10% free. So they recognized we have to stop this gladiator stuff because we're going to look around and going to kill us, which, of course, is going to happen. We had Spartacus. We had some other thing. And we have had Roman rebellions that, of course, the Romans don't deal with anymore. Nonetheless, they made a good decision. But now they have the people, and the question is, how shall we entertain them? Well, the people also had ideas about how they should be entertained because always the people have always liked gossip. So we have gossip. But then how are we going to codify it, right? Well, of course, you know, you also have the Roman churches coming up, so you got that chanting. Somebody said, look, we can put some really good words. John, screwing Jenny, what do you think? And then somebody that's what it amounts. I don't know if you describe, I mean, but it's an accurate description of opera. And, of course, it's going to come up. Opera's all about sex. Is there an opera that's not? I'm trying to think that... my favorite opera is Porgy and Bess, but it's always about sex. And it's always, of course, in a vernacular because, as we know, during this period that I'm now accessing, educated people spoke Latin. Only the uneducated, the people who had spoke the vernacular, spoke Italian. You remember Dante wrote in Italian. Everybody's like, it was a scandal because nobody wrote, no educated person would write in a vernacular. He should have written... His book in Inferno should have been written in Latin, but he did it. So we have a vernacular that's coming up. Spain, because we have the same situation in Spanish, is vernacular, and Germany is a vernacular. And everybody began to see because the people were enjoying what they were doing, so we had this emerging. Now, we are jumping several hundred years, okay? But we are getting to the Bronx. We're getting to a square. Well, it's a block, right? We got a vernacular. We got gossip, because that's what hip-hop has done. It has told the story. People didn't like the story because they didn't like what is being said. Why do they talk like that? Because they unhappy. That's not hard. Because you took everything away from them. These kids that did this went to schools. I went to segregated schools, Knoxville, Tennessee, Cincinnati, Ohio. And in order to keep my school segregated, the white establishment would do whatever they had to do. So we had gym, we had balls, we had bats, we had nets, we had whatever it is, because they didn't want us to be able to sue, which ultimately we're going to do on Brown versus Board of Education. We're going to sue, and we're going to say separate is not equal. So they were going to make sure. When I went to school, Wayne High School, and I was in lower level there, if you wanted to play the what is that thing that I was interested in, the licorice stick, if you wanted to play clarinet, you didn't have a clarinet, they would get you a clarinet. If you wanted to play the bazoon, it didn't matter, whatever you wanted, they would get you. Well, these kids grew up when they took gym away, because they started to say things like, we can't afford the insurance, so we take gym away, so kids don't have any gym. But the kids, being the people, being wonderful people that they are, says, that's okay, we'll break dance. We're going to get exercise. We can handle that. They said, well, we're not going to give you any more band because we can't afford the instruments and you people don't take care of it anyway. They said, well, it's okay. We'll take the old vinyl that you've been throwing away and we'll scratch it. And then they did something else that was so historically important, but a lot of times they didn't realize it. When they didn't have a way to keep the beat, they did a ham bone, right? And they called it the human beatbox. Right? Same thing, keeping a beat. They're coming out of a tradition. And so frequently people didn't realize that this is an old and honorable tradition. We know that this cadence, we're calling this Hip Hop Speaks to Children poetry, a celebration of poetry with a beat. But we know if we go back to slavery times, the slave preacher, who, speaking of unions, who also got us a Sunday off so that we could at least worship. This is an important man. But he wanted people to understand his sermons, and he wanted the sermons to be carried on. Now, we who do history know that James Weldon Johnson, and in the 20s, as we are now coming out of slavery into an emancipation, that James Weldon Johnson wrote down 7 important sermons. Those are not the only 7, but he wrote down the 7 important sermons, and he made a book called God's Trombones. And, of course, we in the black community, because black people are sweet, and we're always trying to show white people that we really speak well and we know what we're doing. So when we, we do. It's precious of us, really. And so when we were sharing these sermons, you know, we would do it like at Easter sermons, you know. Someone would always recite something from God's Trombones. And God stepped out on space, and he looked around, and he said, I'm lonely. Oh, I'm lonely. I think I'll make me a world. Everybody's like, oh, she speaks so well. But we know that if the preacher had preached it like that, nobody would have remembered it. How do you recapture that? So you're going to do that, and God stepped out on space, and he looked around and he said, "Oh, I'm lonely. I think I'll make me a world." Because then somebody said, "What did the preacher say?" He said, "I'm lonely," because you get the beat back. You get the cadence back. That's what these kids have done. And that's why they know a hip hop and a hip hip hop when you and I don't. Because we say, "What the hell are they saying?" But they they are able to capture that cadence. It's such an important part of what we are doing. I wanted the book to start. I actually wanted it to go back to Demosthenes, but they said you cannot do that. And the reason that I did, well, he's the guy. He's the first hip hop group. I could make a case, but I lost the fight on that one. But you remember, he's the guy that put the pebbles in his mouth, that stood on the rock, that talked, right? And so I thought, yeah, he's the first real rapper. And they said, "No, Nikki, you can't. It's bad enough you're doing what you're doing." So what I wanted to do was I wanted to go back to the earliest rap that I could actually share with children. I think we all know probably the earliest rap that's known as rap is a rap called Shine. And Shine was the rap that the black community, I know the word cannot be celebrated, but when the Titanic went down, I think that the black community was extremely, you know, thrilled because, there was no black people on it. They made a point. It wasn't. And they had made a point that there were no black people working on it. You know, it was built. And it's like no black people doing anything with the Titanic. And it's unsinkable. Well, you know, there's not a black person on earth to say something like that. It's like, God gonna get you, you say something like that. And of course, well, it sunk. Quite naturally. So the black community made a, we play the dozens in the black community too. You know, the dozens are like, you know, they call you mother chocolate cake because everybody takes a piece. You know, it's mean, but you know, and it gets worse. But we had a rap that became a part of what the uncles, what I would call what the uncles do. And Shine is going to be the first example of that. Shine is not in here because Shine is a dirty, dirty, dirty rap and there's no child that should hear. I will recite the one line, the one that I can do, and then the rest of it you have to ask some of your other friends. But as the ship is sinking, a man says, "Shine, shine, save poor me, and I'll give you more money than you can see. Well, there's money on land and there's money on sea, but the money on land is money for me," and Shine swam on. And then they're going to be salacious offerings, you know, and it's really funny. So they're just saying that, you know, you can't do that. You know what I like about white Americans? No, there are a number of things that I admire, and I'm sincere about that, but one of the things that I like about it is when you finally say, you know, you really are wrong about that, and you shouldn't have done that, they say, "Okay, we didn't do it." So they finally said, they did. And they finally said, "You know, you all always say that there were no black people on the Titanic, but there was a couple from Jamaica, and they were just very, very light." I say, mm-hmm. That ship sank because y'all needed some black people on that ship. When we know it. So what I wanted to do was roll it back. I wanted to go back to the holiness preacher, and I wanted the youngsters to be able to hear that. Because even today, if you don't have anything to do on a Sunday morning, I know that, and we're in Denver here, but there are still little holiness churches that they preach like that. It's a phenomenon, and it is a beautiful thing to watch. And you get tired of people laughing at us because this man is practicing, or in some cases this woman, an old art that allows this people to say what is being said. Same thing these kids are doing. He's saying, "This is what's going on, and this is how I'm doing it." And that's just a very important part. So that's going to be the oldest rap. The youngest rap in the book is going to be a rap that we don't actually think of as a rap. And it's going to be Martin Luther King Jr. and the March on Washington speech. I had been saying for the longest, I've always wanted actually to hear Ja Rule do it, because I like Ja Rule. I think he has, you know, talented. There are other talented kids, but I thought it'd be good for Ja Rule to do something that made sense. And so I did. I always wanted to hear that speech. You know, "We are here to cash a check, 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 check." And so everybody said, "You know, you've been bitching and moaning about that one. Why don't you do it?" And so my friend Val Gray Ward, who is going to also preach the creation, O'Neal Asana, who raps Dunbar, "We wear the mask that grins and lies." So nobody thinks about Dunbar as a rapper, but, you know, he's got perfect cadence. But Martin had perfect cadence. And so we decided it was time somebody did that. Because if you don't do something with that speech will become a, "And God stepped out on space." And everybody will wonder what made it powerful. Because if it doesn't come into a current voice, the kids will hear it and they will, what makes it make sense. So I really did enjoy. This is a multimedia. So we have archival recordings. You can actually hear Langston Hughes, which is really wonderful. And he's talking about my favorite Langston Hughes period is Theme for English B. And we, thank you, we struggled and struggled and struggled. But we finally decided Theme for English B, which is actually a little bit above the 8-year-old audience we were looking at. This is like 8 and above. So we recognized, okay, we're not going to get Theme for English B, but we did get Dream Boogie. And so we have Langston reading Dream Boogie because I love it so much. We opened with Eloise Greenfield, because I loved it because of the premise. I went to the store to buy some, let me see if I can turn. Went to the corner, walked to the store, bought me some candy, ain't got it no more. Went to the beach, played on the shore, built me a sandhouse, ain't got it no more. Went to the kitchen, lay down on the floor, made me a poem, still got it. And I love that. I wanted to open with that because I wanted to show that poetry lasts. We were all showing sweet things here, but of the sweet things, only one is going to actually have a lasting view. So I was very proud. I am very proud to be working on this book. I had the pleasure of knowing Rosa Parks. And Mrs. Parks was wonderful. She had a great sense of humor. She dropped dead gorgeous. So just a really an extraordinary woman. And I had the kind of sadness. It was personal for me, but my dog died, and her name was Wendy. She was a Karen. And then my mom died, and Mommy died 6 months after Wendy, but for those of us who are dog lovers, it was just like, this is not good. And then my sister died 6 weeks after my mother. So when we literally, Mommy didn't have a reason to die. Let me just share that. I think Mommy just died because she didn't want to bury Gary. But Gary's my sister. But Gary had a lung tumor that had metastasized. So we knew that that's just not going to, you know, there's nothing, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, she's just, that's what's going to be. And Mommy, I just think, just decided, well, we'll let Nikki handle it. I thought it was, I said to somebody recently, I said, you know, I cannot wait till I get to heaven and tell those bitches you were wrong. I have not done this well, you know. But it's like, you're going to leave Nikki and it'll be okay, you know what I'm saying? And they were always done. Even when I was a little girl, I used to do that. You know, Mommy would come and get Gary and they'd go out and get barbecue. She's asleep? No, she's not asleep, you know. And so I think Mommy just like, you know, I'm going to go on now and I'll see you in a bit. And, you know, we'll look out for Nikki another time, you know. And so you're just losing people. And then Rosa died. And then Edna Lewis, for those of you who know Edna died. And so all of a sudden I went from being a baby in the family to being an elder. My Aunt Anne died, and my Aunt Anne and my mom were Irish twins. They were 11 months apart. And so you just look around and it's like, wait a minute. So it's Agnes, my Aunt Agnes and me, and we're all that's left. And so, you know, you're incredibly sad, and so you have to do something. And so what I did was I worked. I've continued, actually, to keep working, because I think when I'm not so sad, I want to go to China. But I don't want to go to China and be looking around every time and say, oh, Mom, you should see this. Or, you know how you, yeah, because you're always thinking, you know, because we always dreamed, and we traveled a lot together, and I'm a mama's girl. So, you know, you miss them. But I was worried about people and Rosa. That's what I said. That's this whole thing started with, I do know what I'm doing here. But I was, I was worried that Rosa faced the same problem that a lot of icons face. And that by being iconic, you forget that she's a human being, and a great human being, and a fun human being. I have to tell you, though, in all fairness, I'm a better cook than Miss Parks was. We used to fight about our meatloaf, because I made a great meatloaf. You know, her husband, Ray, liked meatloaf, and she was like, Raymond loves my meatloaf. And I said, well, you ain't had mine. And then she teased him. But what I decided to do with Rosa, because we had done this book, and I'm so proud of it, and actually she saw that in the F&G stage. And we had, the last time I spoke to Miss Parks, I said, well, I'll see you December 1st, because we were meeting in New York for the publication of Rosa. And she said, well, baby, because she had that, you know, well, baby, if I'm here, I'll be there. But she died, as you know, that October, you know. And then I thought about it, and I said, okay, yeah, there's a book, and people pick up, I mean, there's got to be no history in the United States without Rosa Parks. But people still try to act like, you know, oh, her feet were tired, or, oh, she was, you know, an agitator, or she, you know, whatever craziness is that people think. I mean, people are not, we're not a good species. We really aren't, you know. I mean, you wish we could just do a little better, but it made me crazy. And I thought kids should have a better sense of Rosa. They should be able to access her at a younger age. So I wrote a poem for her. The book Acolytes, and Acolytes is here, so, oh, there. that was the first book that I wrote that my mother didn't see. And it's everything that happened with the people who were dying that I love so much. But with Rosa, I wanted to do something really different because, yeah, I can write about her and I can tell people. But I thought, for that little six-year-old, you know what I'm saying? You want that, even that four-year-old, you want her to have a different sense. It's one of the reasons we wanted to rap Martin, because in rapping Martin, you know, you get that, speaking of that little four-year-old,
what you doing, baby? I need your cash check.
Which is really wonderful, because you know how they do that little thing when they got no hips. And I thought, okay, that they shouldn't. We need to turn Rosa into a dance so that they can begin to understand. So I wrote a poem. I know that it was one of those, like, I really wish she could have seen it, because I think she would have gotten a kick out of it. And it's called Do the Rosa Parks. Do the Rosa Parks. Say no, no. Do the Rosa Parks. Throw your hand in the air. Do the Rosa Parks. Say no, no. Do the Rosa Parks. Tell them that's not fair. Somebody's crying, Rosa Parks them. Somebody's lying, Rosa Parks them. Shame the bad, comfort the good. Do the Rosa Parks just like she would. Sit down. Stand up. Sit down. Let's do the Rosa Parks all over town. I love that. Please go on in. So what I was trying to do in this book is to bring alive some of the people that I had the pleasure of knowing, to change maybe a little bit of how we looked at some of the people that I didn't. And I did know Gwen Brooks. Actually, Gwen Brooks and I share a birthday, June 7th, as we do with Anna Karnikova and as we do with Prince, among other people. Yeah, June 7th is like some good vibes there, or something like that. And we could have used an archival on Gwen, by the way, but we decided, because again, I wanted her wrapped, so I'm the one that's going to wrap, and I ham-boned We Real Cool, and we have a DVD of it.
For those, you can see I have on mitts, and you can't ham-bone in mitts, and so we were doing a DVD, and I dropped my pants, and everybody was like, oh my God.
I'm a 65-year-old woman, so that's not sexy. That's kind of, that's kind of horrible. But I really enjoyed, and I just wanted to share, and I'm glad that we're here tonight. I really enjoyed working on this book, and I'm hoping that this book creates a conversation. This is Hip Hop Speaks to Children, but there's Hip Hop Speaks to Teenagers, Hip Hop Speaks to Adults. There is history, and I am a big, big, big fan of history. If there's one thing that I am just sorry about for American children, is that they're kind of grown up in a world where there is no history, where there's no how did this happen and what happened when and how does that connect and what does that mean. Everything is kind of like Google. And I'm always on my, I teach at Virginia Tech, and I'm always on my students because Google is just Family Feud on steroids. It's true, because you Google something. I remember, don't ask me why I look at Family Feud, because I shouldn't. But, you know, because you're home and you can turn on TV, you know what I'm saying? And that was when Richard was there. And Richard Dawson, you know, we ask 100 people to name their favorite fish. I don't even want to ask you all to guess what their favorite fish was. 100 people said their favorite fish was lobster. Hi, guys, lobster's not a fish. Google does that. You ask a question and they tell you what 100 people said or what the first people said. It's not necessarily the answer. And so you have to be very, very careful when you Google. Just remember, it's Family Feud on steroids. You're not going to get the right answer because there's no depth. And I'm not picking on Google, and I wish I'd had stock and things. Well, now, who cares? We're all going down. It doesn't matter. No, we're not, actually, and I love that. You know, this is monopoly. United States is monopoly. They just print more money. And I saw today they were mad, and they were like, if we print more money, we'll have inflation, but if we don't print more money, we'll have depression. I don't mind paying $12,000 for a loaf of bread. It don't bother me. They need to put people to work because we need a train system, and that would be the first thing. America needs to get back to doing something real besides playing with money, but that's not what I'm here for tonight. that's the truth. I wanted to share this book. I'm very, very excited and very pleased about Hip Hop Speaks to Children. I think the librarians have been enjoying it, and that's very much important to me because, you know, kids come into the library and it's like, you know, I want to know something about it. And what they hear about hip hop, they hear in really salacious terms. They see a couple of women coming out of a swimming pool and some guy standing there in a jet plane in the back, and somehow or another that's supposed to represent something, and that's not what it is. That's not what hip-hop is. That's not what it stands for. And so I think that those of us who care what the kids are doing have to find a way to take it back and put it back in perspective, and that's what I'm trying to do with this book here. So thank you for indulging me on this one. I received a call. Now, all I know about children's books is that both Rosa and on this book, I received a call from my editor. Her name is Laura Godwin. She's a really nice person. And I am not the writer that thinks that there shouldn't be editors. Editors are important. I was always a fan of Max Perkins, for those of you who keep up with things like that. The books would have been different without Max. There's just no question about it. But Laura calls me and she says, Nikki, you know, 200th anniversary of Lincoln is coming up. Would you like to do something on Lincoln? And I said, no, I wouldn't, because, well, I'm not. I'm just a poet. And Lincoln is the most written about president that we've ever had. And so what I bring to that table is just, to me, going to be totally insufficient. You know, it's just like, no, I'm not interested in that. And we chatted back and forth and back and forth. I think Laura enjoys working with me as much as I enjoy working with her. You know, it's kind of mutual. And she was like, well, we'd like to do something with that. I said, I don't know, you know. The only thing that really interests me is his friendship with Fred Douglas. And she said he had a friendship with Fred Douglas. And I said, yeah, he had a friendship. They were, you know, Douglas was not the shoeshine boy here. I mean, that was a mutual situation. And I said, I would love to explore that, but nobody's going to be interested in that. In order to research a book like this, you have to actually, in order to research this book, forget like, you had to actually read Lincoln and his papers, and you have to read Douglas and his papers. And I was very fortunate. I live over in Blacksburg, but I was over at the Smithsonian shortly after we had agreed to this, and they were doing, which was so wonderful and so lucky because it saved me a lot of time, they were doing the second inaugural. Now, I did know, I'm a history major at Fisk University, I did know that Fred Douglas was invited with his wife to the inaugural, to the second inaugural, right? But because the Smithsonian had the exhibit going, I could find it. I could find the list. And of course, you know, there's a huge food fight at the second inaugural. But we didn't do that. Because so many people came, people started pushing. And the food was late getting there. By the time the food came, people were snatching. And, you know, they had, you know, big pieces of meat and it's all on the floor. And it was a mess. But that's not why we were. Right? So I wanted to show how these two men and their mutual trust in each other, how they, you know, that game that the kids used to play. What's it called? Where you fall, you know. Do you remember what it's called? You know what I'm saying? And your friends are supposed to catch you, and you worry about it. But these two guys have, well, you do, because, you know, you friends, you never know how many of them have them. And these two guys kind of depended upon each other. So I wanted to start the book on the inaugural. Now, of course, I'm working again with Brian Collier, and Brian, of course, took Caldecott honors for Rosa, and I hope that he gets it again. We have a dual page on the Emancipation Proclamation, because that's what Lincoln is known for, though Lincoln did many other good things, and that's the truth. And the emancipation is important, but the emancipation only relieved slavery in the states against in rebellion. So it's a political document. It is not an ethical document in any sense of the word, but it's okay. It was a pretty night. We knew that. I love the weather. I love the Weather Channel, and I was just talking on this book tour. Don't you? As you follow the winds, you follow the seeds, and so goes the seeds, so goes political power. There's no question. There was a time, and all of us who are Christians in this room are of the Judeo-Christian persuasion, all of us know that everybody had to go to Egypt, because Egypt was what, boys and girls? The bread basket. If Egypt hadn't had that wheat, nobody give a damn about Egypt. It was important. If you know who has the bread, it's one of the problems that the reason that we are constantly at war. This is not Nikki's thing on that. If and when the United States, before we created the Dust Bowl, before we ruined beautiful lands of ours, before we got crazy and decided we could plant in deserts, we had a bountiful nation, and that allowed us to be a powerful nation. And then our next job was to be a good nation. We've missed a few steps along the way. But right now, no, we're not finished, but that's a part of it. If you're not feeding yourself, you're not going to be good, and you're not going to be kind, and you're not going to be patient. It's just a part of what we do. And you can't keep throwing dams up every time you want to do something, because the river, Colorado River, suffers. I don't have to tell you all that. It suffers. It's losing inches every year because somebody's sitting up in the desert that wants to grow wheat. That's not what you do, baby. If you want to grow wheat, you come to the plains. But that would be another discussion. It was a pretty night. And one of the things you always want to do if you're doing something, find out what the weather was when you're talking about, because that will always make a difference, right? The stars were out and they were shining, and everybody was happy. Now, we know Mary Todd Lincoln. And Mary Todd Lincoln was not a nice person. I never did really, I still don't know why Abe married her. Well, she had a little something, you know, and he was a poor boy, so it was a good move, I guess, on his part. But she's not a nice person. And so Abraham and Mary are walking hand in hand, arm in arm. And I think actually he liked her, but that'd be another discussion too. But they're walking arm in arm, and he is being distracted. And she finally says, Abraham, you seem like you're looking for something. What does it matter? And he said, I'm looking for my friend Fred Douglas. Now that we have, we're going to have the line, here comes my friend Douglas. It's going to be in both men's papers and in things that talk about. So we had the line that we needed to prove what I was trying to prove here, that these guys had high regard for each other. Now, Laura's really sweet. Laura said to me, because Abraham says, I'm looking for my friend Fred Douglas. And Mary Tidling says, oh, Abe, you shouldn't have invited a Negro to the White House. And, of course, Lincoln shakes his head more in sadness than disappointment. He knows his wife because she was not a friend. Laura said to me, oh, you know, you probably made a bit of a bigot out of Mary Todd Lincoln. I said, I didn't make a bigot out of Mary Todd Lincoln. I didn't talk to her mother or father. I mean, talk to somebody that had some influence on her. I just described what she was. And so Mary, I did. I don't dislike her, something that she was. And so Mary said, Laura said to me, well, I'm not so sure about that. I said, okay, Laura, what makes her different from the other 43? And so we had that discussion. And Laura said, all 43 are not bigots. I said, okay, let's find five who weren't. Now, you all may disagree. We started, of course, with Jane Addams, because Jane was a feminist very early on, a very bright, very wonderful woman. We went to Dolly Madison, right? And then there's no way. You have to come to Eleanor Roosevelt, because Lou Hoover and all them were terrible people. You have to, they were. You have to come to Eleanor, right? And then you get Eleanor. Well, what you got between Eleanor, you got Mamie and them? Come on now, that's Truman. So then you have to come to Jackie Kennedy, right? Right? And then you're really having a bit of a problem because you are. We are all going to hope for Hillary. We're going to hope that she comes through. And as a disclaimer, let me say that Lady Bird Johnson and I used to have lunches. I went down to Texas and visited her. She was as nice as she could be to me, and obviously I'm a black person. But just because you have black friends doesn't make you not be a bigot. And you could ask Strom Thurmond. Well, so we got four, and one is pending because... Well, we're cheering for, you know, Michelle. You know, because Michelle brings shoulders back. We haven't had shoulders on a first lady since Jackie. And it's so cool because Michelle will wear those, you know, she has shoulders. And then she has a big behind, and it's just like, oh, wow, I really like that. I really do. So she'll be my fifth. So Lincoln spots Douglas and says, here comes my friend Douglas. And what we wanted to do was to keep the movement, and movement is going to be important because it is a children's book. And so what we're doing now, we're going to show you the movement of the two men across the ballroom to each other. Douglas, of course, is running off of the plantation. Lincoln, of course, is moving up into Illinois. They're both trying to better them. Both men had in common bettering themselves. And at that point, literacy was one of the major, major ways that you bettered yourself. You learned to read and you write, and you learned to write. We do recognize, and it's so, I think, instructive. I think that we all agree, the world agrees, that Abraham Lincoln was one of our very great, I think normally when we do presidents, we rate George Washington first because he had a sense to get out. But we certainly rate Lincoln second. And it's amazing because he had, what, three books, or two books and a document. He had the Bible, and he had Pilgrim's Progress, and he had the Constitution. And he became one of the nicest, calmest, best leaders. I think without Lincoln, it would have been a very different, it clearly was. It clearly was going to be a very different world. So he made the very best of it. We know that Douglas worked on the docks in Baltimore and dreamed of going abroad, and ultimately he's going to get abroad. We know that Lincoln took food down to, took a load of produce down to New Orleans, and we know he saw slavery. And I'm going to pull it down for a second. We know that he saw slavery firsthand for the first time. But this is a children's book, so you can't put everything you know into these few pages. But I just want to point out that Abraham Lincoln knew, as did any other white man who wanted to be free, and he will ultimately articulate that, a nation cannot exist half slave and half free. If Abraham Lincoln wants to be in Illinois and just till his own land, if the slaveocracy comes in, he will lose the land. And his ambition will change from being a farmer able to take care of his own family to being an overseer. And the only thing that will make him a human being is that he's over somebody who is less. That was not what he wanted, and that was not what a man named John Brown wanted, who was in Nebraska. We have Lincoln being perplexed. We know that when Lincoln, and I'll get back to, we're going to get to John. We know that Lincoln was elected to the House of Representatives, and we know that Fred Douglas called on all of the new representatives and senators. And not all of them, of course, would see him. Not everybody's going to see an ex-slave. But Lincoln was interested. The term that I use is one wanted to teach and one wanted to learn. And they found that they had a lot in common because they both had this very droll sense of humor. I mean, you read the biography. They both had this very droll sense of humor. They both liked good food. And they both had a view of the world, that the world should be a just and benign place. And so Lincoln and Douglas became friends. Now, of course, they're going to have difficulty in meeting. It's never going to be, you know, Abe and Fred. It's always going to be Mr. Lincoln and Frederick, because that's the nature of the game. So to say that they were friends is not to say that they drank a beer together, but that they did have high regard. I love this. This is one of my favorite parts of the book, because Brian has, as you can see, a young black boy looking out, and what he's saying, is this flag going to protect me? Can I have the protection of this flag? And the answer in 1954 is going to be, yes, we will, but it's going to take a while to get there. This is John Brown. John Brown would have been a deal breaker. John Brown had to be in this book because the Civil War started, not because the South fired on Fort Sumter. Civil War started because this man, John Brown, took two of his sons and from Nebraska, and he was going over to Harper's Ferry. He was going to take the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, which at that point was still in Virginia. And he was going to arm the slaves, and there was going to be a rebellion, and they would be free. Frederick Douglass knew John Brown. And when John Brown had started his rebellion in Cincinnati, where those people had gotten killed, John Brown came to Frederick Douglass's farm, where he rested. And he told Douglass what his plans were. Douglass said, you know, this is a foolhardy plan. He's right. I mean, Douglass knew that. But Douglass said, I'll help you raise funds. We do know that John Brown, of course, ultimately did attack Harper's Ferry. We do know that he took two of his sons with him. And I stress that again, because any of us who are parents in this room, you know we do not put our children in harm's way if there's a way out of it, if there's a way that we cannot. So when he took his sons, he was serious about what he wanted their lives to be. Two of his sons stayed at home. We do know that John Brown was unsuccessful, and we know that he and his men, who were not killed outright, were hanged later. We also know that John Brown's body, we understand. If John Brown had been fighting for the slave owners, if John Brown had been fighting for the powerful, we'd have malls named after John Brown. There'd be statues of John Brown all over the place. Everybody's, oh yeah, I live on John Brown Avenue. But because he offered the protection that he could to a weak and vulnerable people, we've made him a fool and an idiot, and somehow or another we wish we could erase him, but we can't. This was the other deal breaker here, and her name is Mary Ellen Pleasant. She was known as Mammy Pleasant. And Mammy Pleasant had been a slave. She too had escaped a Maryland plantation. She too knew Frederick Douglass. So Douglass is so key when we look at American history, his connections. But she continued west. She went out to San Francisco. And when she was there, she was a slave. She already knew how to work hard. And as we know, any of us that know anything about the 49ers, the people that made the money were not the men going there hunting for the gold and stuff. The people that made the money were the people that did things for them. Levi Strauss made the money. Hearst made the money. The people that bought property, the people that did things. Mammy Pleasant washed clothes because they were dirty and they were tired. And she would wash clothes, but she did what my grandmother used to do. She's up before dawn and she put on a stew. On wash day, grandmother washed on Mondays. But on wash day, she would start her soup or stew early. Mammy started her superstore. She had her fire, and she would put it on. So when people were bringing their clothes or picking up their clothes, they were smelling it. So people said, you know, well, would you sell me a bowl of the soup? And she said, of course, because she recognized an opportunity. And so she started to have a couple of those so that she could do that. She saved her pennies. She befriended politicians, and they befriended her. They treat Mammy Pleasant like some people want to treat Mary Magdalene. They want to make her something that she never was. They want to sort of take away what it is that she did that was so good. Mammy saved her money and bought property. People would say, you know, if you buy in the Knob Hill area, it's going to be good. They, you know, they gave her tips, and she had enough sense to take it. So she had money. When she heard that John Brown needed money, she decided to send money, but more. She thought it was a righteous cause because she hated slavery, and she said, I will join him. She made her way back. We have her here being stopped. She was stopped in Ohio. I mentioned Cincinnati, but I actually don't live in Cincinnati. I live in Virginia now, but I live in a part of southern Ohio that's known as the Valley. And that's because at one point we were going to go make a canal from the Erie, canal from the Erie Canal to the Ohio River. It's going to come through, and it's going to come through the Valley. And that's going to be the old stagecoach route. So along that route is something called a Golden Lamb. And if you're out in Ohio sometime or you're driving through, stop at the Golden Lamb because it's the oldest continually operating establishment like that. Mammy Pleasant got into the Yellow Springs area. And people who knew who she was passed the word to her, all is lost. And fortunately that happened because what she did was turn around and went back to San Francisco. Now you can Google, I was talking about Google, but you can Google and you'll find Mary Ellen Pleasant because she was an important part of San Francisco and how it grew. Mary Ellen, though, was always committed to freedom. And what she did was to take the money that she had, and she's always going to make money, and bought herself a headstone. And the headstone says, to this day, she was a friend of John Brown's. She was a committed woman. And she had to be here because people need to know that there were many, many people who were against this thing. It wasn't just a couple of wild-eyed radicals. Brian is always going to show you Abraham Lincoln with things to his back because we know that Lincoln is not going to come through. We are going to see Douglas in a little more light. The two men cross the room and meet each other. And even on that festive occasion, see if I can get this. The Civil War, which was a bloody and sad, Brian loves Gates. The Civil War is going to hang over the room. But Lincoln and Douglas meet, and Lincoln says, you know, how are you? He's glad to see him. He said, I thought I saw you a bit ago. And Douglas says, yes, but there was some confusion about the door through which I was to enter. And Lincoln says to him, because we know that, because we have notes on that, look out for my friend Frederick Douglass. He and his wife were coming. His secretary, his name is Kennedy, as you remember. I was talking about historical ironies. Jack Kennedy's secretary was Ms. Lincoln. Yeah, and Lincoln's secretary was Kennedy. So it's kind of interesting. But he said, I told my secretary to look out for you. And he said, yes, sir, but you didn't tell him that we are colored. And so he said, oh, I'm sorry. And Lincoln said, Douglas said, it's okay. You know, it's not a big deal one way or the other. We're here and everything is fine. And I had to give a shout out to Martin Luther King because I put these words in Lincoln's mouth. He says, you know, Lincoln says to Douglas, well, I'm glad you're here, but there are going to be difficult days ahead. And, you know, that was what Martin said in Memphis. We face difficult days ahead. And I thought we're still taking great men and putting... They're all saying the same thing. But Douglas is going to say to Lincoln, yes, but we have the right captain to steer the good ship America. And we have a line in there that I also love because, you know, the second inaugural address is with malice toward none, with charity for all, with right as God gives us to know the right. And so we have Lincoln and Douglas are standing there. They're just two young men, and that's what made it so wonderful. And Brian, in his research, is showing, you know, because you always think of Lincoln as old and beat up. He's showing these two young men. So I'm extremely proud of this particular book. But in many respects, this is my heart, and then I'll let you go. But my grandfather was 20 years older than my grandmother. And he met grandmother, she was 18, he was 38, and he was married. And that's true. And I don't know. I think Grandpapa was just fascinated. I really don't know. I mean, I just know that Grandpapa used to always say, I live with them. And Grandpapa would say, you know, I only wanted to kiss your grandmother. He'd be teasing her about something. And he'd say, I only wanted to kiss your grandmother. And his name was John Brown Watson, by the way. And she would say, John Brown, if I had let you kiss me, you would have never married me. And, of course, you cannot corrupt the innocent. And I was thinking, why did she kiss the guy? And then I was old before I realized, oh, that's a metaphor. That's a metaphor. So Grandpapa had to get a divorce, of course, and because that's what was going to happen, and he wanted to marry Grandmother because that's the way that was going to go down, and it did, you know. But now we have a young woman with an old man. They had three daughters, my mother and my Aunt Ann and my Aunt A. And all of a sudden, when we come along, my mother was the first to get married, so they got married essentially. You know, my mother married first, and Agnes, my youngest aunt, married next, and then my Aunt Ann married. But Mommy married, and she had two daughters, right? She had my sister Gary, and she had me. So by the time we meet Grandpapa, he is an old man. Now, Grandpapa was never, I never heard him raise his voice. His idea of being unhappy was, oh, my. And when you heard, oh, my, everybody scattered. Because you knew we had had it. Now, for some reason, Grandpapa liked me. I think that I was I was probably the only grandchild that didn't really get on his nerves. So he would, because you know how children are. They ask stupid questions, and I really avoided all of that. And they always want something that's not wantable, you know. And I don't know, he liked me. But he would say, when I'm down there visiting, he'd say, well, Nikki, let's go look at the stars. And it was always a thrill because he didn't take my cousin William or my cousin Tara or my sister. He would say, Nikki. And it's like, yeah, yeah. And so... They lived across the street from Cal Johnson Park, and we would walk over, and he loved to tell you about the stars. I think one reason I'm in love with the sky and space right now is Grandpapa. And he would say, now that's Orion's belt, and that's the North Star. You know, he would point out all of the things to me, and of course, he was a Latin scholar at Fisk University 1905. And so he knew Latin names, which I'm not that good at, but, you know, I can do Ursa Minor and that kind of thing. And so he would tell me this, but he also liked to read to me. And he would read Aesop. And, you know, Aesop is pithy. I know, even as a little child, I knew something's wrong here. But you know how there's just some things you know. And I'm thinking, this isn't right to me. But, you know, you'd have to read about the crow grapes and, you know, just the things that you'd have to do. And he also liked Greek myths, so you'd get Narcissus and all of that stuff. And I knew he was making a message, you know what I'm saying? But I was always offended when it came to the grasshopper and the ants. And that was the one that I would end up saying things like, Grandpa, that's not right. Because the grasshoppers are making music, the ants are working, and all of a sudden it's winter, the grasshopper goes to the ants and the ants say, no, they close their door. We told you to save up for a rainy day, as it were. My grandmother, which by extension my grandfather, we're Southerners, we're in Knoxville, Tennessee. Nobody ever came to our door that grandmother didn't find a way to give them something, a plate or a little money or something. We never turned anybody down. And so I couldn't see where the ants got off being this, you know what I'm saying? And it stayed with me. And I was talking to my editor, Mark Aronson, and I said, Mark, I've just had it. I'm sick of the grass. So something else had come up. And he said, well, why don't you write it? And I said, I think I will. And so I was thinking it through, and I started. My first line in my book says, James, and I named the grasshopper James Ignatius Grasshopper. James Ignatius Grasshopper was furious. And he is at the law firm of Robin, and Wren, which is the best law firm in the meadow. And he is saying to Harry Robin, I want to sue the ants. And Jimmy Grasshopper is an American. We sue. And Harry Robin says to him, what do you want to sue for? And of course, I had to give a shout out to Aretha. He said, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Because it's disgraceful. He said, I make music all summer long. I make music. I set the cadence by which they harvested their goods. It is a known fact, and it is, that the ants don't have a voice. The reason people buy ant farms for their children is they don't have to hear it. If you had anything else, they'd be making racket all the time. You don't have to hear it, right? The ants have no voice, and they had no ability to organize themselves if the grasshopper doesn't set the cadence by which they work. Then all of a sudden, the ants are like, we're not having any of it. You didn't do anything. So Jimmy Grasshopper is going to be the plaintiff here. And as he opens the case, I wanted the kids to understand how we do a case, so the plaintiff and defendant. But as the plaintiff, he states his case. Am I not worthy of my bread? Didn't I do something? I'm an artist. Are you telling me that the work, that the music that I made was unimportant? I set the tone for you to work your crops. At lunch, when everybody was tired, I was tired also. I made music to help you digest your food. We know that you go in any kind of old restaurant and they're playing some old 60-something. We know that in the evening, when work was over, Jimmy made music so that people could relax. So, and as they relax, they could sleep better. We know that music soothes us. You get into any old elevator, you got music going on. Because people know you're in a box that could fall. And they don't want you... It's true. They don't want you to think about it. Music is absolutely crucial. The answer being represented by butterfly, butterfly, moth, and slug. So Osceola's slug is ringing, and she's saying to Mr. Grasshopper, well, Mr. Grasshopper, you're talking about what you did, but did we ask, do you have a contract? Did my clients contract with you for you to make the music? And he says, no, but I did. They said, no. Did, yes or no? And she said, no. So we get redirect. And on redirect, Laurie Wren says to Mr. Grasshopper, what did you think you were doing? He said, I thought I was a part of it. Because we have to remember that the United States, as we know it, as I stand here, is not based on the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution is based on the Mayflower Compact. I live in the state of Virginia, which is actually not a state, but the Commonwealth of Virginia. Massachusetts is a Commonwealth. Kentucky is a Commonwealth. The compact says that we will be of mutual assistance to each other. It's why when Hurricane Katrina blew New Orleans down, people said, what are we doing to help those people? It's not about did they have insurance and did they have insurance against wind and water. It's about we are having people in trouble. When the West has its fires, nobody sits around and says, well, goodness gracious, you shouldn't be smoking or something. People say, let us come and help you. We in Virginia send Firefly because we have a compact. And the compact takes precedence over a contract. Because a contract is a legal document that says you will and won't do things. A compact is an emotional document that says we are human beings, and in times of need, we will respond to each other. Dr. Michael Secretary Bird flies over from Kenya because I am a huge fan of The Godfather. I am. Michael, are you going to kill everybody? Just my enemies. Oh, I love Michael. And you remember when the brother came over in Godfather 2, he flew over from Italy and just sat down and went back. So I have Michael Secretary Bird come over, and I have to give a shout out to Brown versus Board of Education here, because when he takes the stand, he says new information has been learned about what music means. And of course we know new information is how we're going to get the Brown decision, right? And of course, again, Miss Slug is trying to say, well, the ants didn't ask for it. But the point is, the ants accepted it. And when you accept the gift that people give you, it's why you can't let everybody fall in love with you. It is. I don't know if you all are basketball fans, but there's a guy named Luke Walton. He's a great kid, Bill Walton's son. There's a woman stalking him now. Yeah. You don't do women that stalk you. You know what I'm saying? He doesn't know her, but she's stalking him. You don't let everybody fall in love with you because it's complicated. And it can be ugly. So you have to make sure that when you accept a gift, and there are things. I have a son, and I remember one of his girlfriends gave him a jacket. And it's like, no, baby, I give you jackets. Yeah, she can give you a comic book or something, but, you know. No, you can't let your child grow up accepting those kind of gifts from strangers. First of all, it makes them crazy. And it does, because then they think strangers should do that. And it makes you crazy because you're letting somebody take care of your child. You don't let anybody feed your dog. Why are you going to let somebody give your kid something? Or I don't. I mean, if any dog lovers, you're not going to let anybody feed your dog. You barely let people, you know, pet them. You really let people, can I pet your dog? Yep. Because you don't want everybody around your dog. So, you don't. So what we're having here, I gave the jury over to the ants, because I'm not afraid. It's never going to bother me. A jury of the peers, we gave it a jury of the ants peers. We had the termites and titmites, and we have all of the... Now, I don't want to put in, you know, dragonflies or something. Somebody says, well, sure, the jury did it. They're all dragonflies, a predator, praying mantis or something. I gave the jury over to the ants. And the question is going to come down. Is art worth something? has the work of our heart and our spirit, is that on par with the work of our hands? Is it that one person worked and another played? I don't think that Mr. Grasshopper played. And actually, the judge is going to give a charge that says we are here to decide whether or not art is worthy of its bread. This is the charge to the jury. The jury, of course, is going to go off, and they are going to make a decision. And I was so happy for the jury. They did the right thing. Oh, you never know. And the jury comes back with a unanimous decision, which was important. I should show you the jury too. With a unanimous decision for Mr. Grasshopper. Now, this is a children's book, and the rule in children's books is, and they lived happily ever after. Now, the last line that I had in this book, because I'm not a child and I'm not a nice person, was, and the ants were ashamed of themselves. Well, they should have been, you know. And Laura's on the phone to me, like, Nikki, kids will be reading this, they'll be crying their eyes out. You can't leave it like that. And I said, but the ants should be ashamed of themselves. They tried to screw the grasshopper. He won. They lost, and they ought to learn something. She can't do it. So what we did, because you try to be fair about these things, so what we did was we have Mr. Grasshopper pick up his fiddle, and he won. And that's what I like about Black Americans, period, is what I like about them, most people, really. He won, so he picks up his fiddle, and he strikes a tune, and Abigail and Nestor Ant are kind of shaking their heads and walking away, and he said, oh, come on, we've been friends. I won. I'm going to get what I'm supposed to get. Let's dance. And they come back, and that was a good day.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Julia Glass, Alice Schroeder, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 8th, 2008.